You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. And it's really a pleasure to present this very important discussion, we feel, around antitrust. Last week, we saw a major hearing in the House Judiciary Committee, which coordinated a series of discussions over the past year. And a lot of it culminated last week on Wednesday when the committee brought together four of the biggest CEOs in Silicon Valley, Sundar Pichai, Mark Zuckerberg, Tim Cook and Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. And what we found in the hearing was essentially that the industry has been doing a lot of things that consumers wouldn't expect. And I think this really puts in stark resolution the power of Silicon Valley in the context of our national economy and the global economy today, which has really put this hearing at the center of controversy for many. Really, the topics that were under discussion, you know, have big tech companies like Google and Facebook gotten too big? Have the executives of these companies become too powerful politically? Have these companies become too powerful? Have they started to engage in a systemic and very silent sort of exploitation of consumers? Do they have too much power in the context of speech and our regulation of misinformation and other forms of offending content? These are the things that we want to talk more about today. Over the next hour, and I'm really pleased to be joined by Tom Wheeler, Kara Swisher, and Oliver Darcy. With that, you know, I really want to say thank you to all three of them, I'll introduce each as we begin to get into these issues. I want to start with Kara. Kara is very well known to most or many on this call as the co-founder and editor of Recode, she's of course also the producer and the host of Recode Decode and Pivot, both of which many millions of people I believe listen to. And Kara has also been, over the past year or so, writing for the New York Times as a columnist on technology issues, which, again, millions of people have been following along very closely. Kara, I want to ask you, what did you make of the hearing last week, especially in the context of, you know, many people have been asking this question of, do these hearings mean anything? Are we really making any sort of progress whatsoever? There's all this talk about Democrat-Republican intrigue and infighting within the committee and outside of the committee, of course. Did this hearing bring us forward? Did it move the consumer issues that we care about in the face of Silicon Valley so much today? Did it move those issues forward in your view?
Well, you know, I think what you have to look at is what the goal was. I mean, they have been doing this investigation for a long time, and they've been collecting things like the emails and everything else. And so they have to sort of have this sort of louder hearing with these CEOs to talk to them publicly and for the public to see. I had an extraordinarily low bar for this, I have to say. I thought it was a lot of pomp and circumstance. I thought remotely it was problematic. It doesn't have the drama and things like that. And actually, it actually helped because I think it did sort of make these executives seem a little smaller and a little more clear of what they were saying, including some of these very damning emails at Facebook, for example, around neutralizing and land grab and how they looked at the Instagram acquisition to Jeff Bezos having to admit that they were misusing information. So there was a lot going on there. And I do think, I just have interviewed David Cicilline, who is the head of this committee. And I think there's a lot more bipartisanship. Let's remove Jim Jordan, who just showed up, you know, at the party, you know, sleeves rolled up and yelling about conservative bias, which had nothing to do with anything here. He didn't read the sign on the door. But otherwise, I think there's a lot more bipartisan support for the issues around the power, because everything stems, it's a systemic thing. Everything stems from the power. Whether you think there's conservative bias, which is, I'm sorry, nonsense, or you think, you know, other things, you think they, the pricing is wrong, the marketplace, everything stems from the power that they have. And I think they stuck pretty closely to that issue and what to do about antitrust going forward. And the last thing is, I'd say, I think they differentiated between the companies rather well. One of my issues is thinking of big tech as a monolith, and the problems that Facebook has are different from the problems that Google has, than Amazon has, than Apple has. And you could stack rank them very easily, but they're, and they each require a different solution. So I thought that was good too. I thought that was an interesting, I think people are able to understand power is the problem, and that really is what's going on here.
Thanks, Kara. I think that's a wonderful overview, and really, really perceptive insights there on the tensions between Democrats and Republicans, and beyond that. And I tend to agree that we did seem to make some progress. But I want to turn to Oliver. Oliver Darcy, senior media reporter for CNN, covering media, politics, technology. He appears very frequently on CNN, of course, and is a regular guest on Brian Stelter's Reliable Sources, and someone that I've looked to as a very even-minded voice in this very noisy media atmosphere that we have today. He's done award-winning reporting, some of it has covered this polarization in the media that we've heard so much about. And so I want to jump to that, Oliver. And Kara, of course, alluded to this. Did you find, Oliver, just to give a little bit more context, very briefly. We've heard a lot about tension between Democrats and Republicans. That certainly was illustrated through Jim Jordan and perhaps one or two others during the hearing last week, where Democrats have tended to focus on economic issues. Conservatives have tended to focus, at least in the case of President Trump or Senator Ted Cruz, for example, on speech related issues. Mm-hmm. In the face of tech, did you see that as a the theme of the hearing last week, or kind of as a sideshow that we should focus less on and focus more on the technical advances that were made last week, as well as kind of the economic analyses?
Well, I think, like Kara said, my bar for this hearing was quite low heading in, just judging from the previous hearings. And so I do think that there was some advancement from certain members of the committee on legitimate antitrust issues. That said, I thought actually a lot of the progress was not really during the interviews of the big tech CEOs, but mostly the documents that the investigation had produced over the past months of investigations. So I thought that was interesting. But, and in the format, too, the 5 minutes, you know, for a Democrat, 5 minutes for a Republican, I thought made it difficult if you're an average consumer to follow because of the point you're making, which is that the Republicans, Jim Jordan, Matt Gaetz, and others were a lot more focused on claims, which are largely unfounded, of conservative bias in tech. And some of the committee members even questioning, there was that one moment where one committee member questioned Mark Zuckerberg about supposed bias on Twitter. And it just, you know, didn't really add anything to the discussion other than to really humiliate that congressman. So I think this is definitely a sideshow. Republicans will say that this stems, like what Kara said, from the fact that big tech has too much power, and so that their claims of conservative bias fall under the antitrust umbrella. I guess you could make that argument, but it's not, you know, terribly compelling to me. I think a lot of the other arguments about antitrust, Zuckerberg, for instance, buying Instagram or Amazon using data to help its own private label were a lot more compelling. I wish we had seen more of that from the Republicans, because this should be an issue that interests them, but they seem just obsessed with this these claims of censoring, you know, crazy blogs like the Gateway Pundit, it's frustrating to watch. We've done a lot of hearings like this, and we just keep hearing these claims over and over again, and then these CEOs have to constantly rebut them. And one final point that I'll make, though, is that I think we watched, or the country really heard two hearings last week. If you watched Fox, for instance, after this, the only thing, or at least one of the main things they focused on, were claims of anti-conservative bias. Whereas if you had, read Kara or The Times or the Post, you would have seen a different conversation focused on the antitrust issue. So what the country took away from that hearing was split largely on ideological lines, where you get your media.
I think that's a very fair analysis, Oliver. I want to jump to Tom and get into the details of the hearing a little bit. I'm on a panel where I definitely need an introduction, but none of the three of these guests needs an introduction. Tom Wheeler was the chairman of the FCC under President Obama from 2013 to 2017. And prior to that had a long and varied career in venture capital, in politics in DC, and many other fields. Tom, I want to ask you, and by the way, I've also had the pleasure, after looking up to Tom for a while, I've had the real pleasure to work with Tom at Harvard through our project, the Digital Platforms and Democracy Project, at the Shorenstein Center, and the Musavvar Rahmani Center. Tom, I want to ask you your perspective on these hearings. You know, having served as chairman of the FCC and having watched this competition policy debate over Silicon Valley unfold over several years, and also served in an executive role where you had to look at competition policy issues in telecommunications industry and other subsectors of this these industries. What were your takeaways? Did we move the ball forward in any sense during the hearings last week? What were the two or three main developments that you think came from this hearing, and what do you think this is going to lead to in the longer run, Tom? And Tom, by the way, please tell us, Tom, where you're from and where you are, rather, and why you're dialing in.
Yeah, I apologize for the fact that I'm coming in by this old technology called a cell phone, because I'm in the middle of an area that was hit by the hurricane today, and we have no electric power. Therefore, I can't get out other than by good old cell phone. Thanks for involving me, Dipayan. And to start off with, hey, Dipayan, congratulations on Terms of Disservice. What a great book. You know, somebody commented the other day that you are becoming the Upton Sinclair of the digital era, and that's what this book does. I think that's probably a good fit. So congratulations on your book. But I agree with Kara and Oliver on both the expectations for the hearing and the performances at the hearing. The Democrats, Fassolini has done a terrific job leading this entire process. I mean, they came prepared. The number of congressional hearings that you roll into where people are sitting there reading canned questions that were provided them by somebody else, this is something where the committee had prepared, and then the committee had turned around and prepared its members. on the Democratic side, at least. In terms of what happens next, Chairman Cicilline has said he's going to put out a report. It'll be interesting to see whether there are Republican members who sign on to that. I agree. Yes, there were some Republican members who participated, other than using this as an exercise to work the refs just before the election to try and get some favorable spin out of social media. But it'll be interesting to see what the Republicans decide to do, because obviously there was a lot of substance. And the hearing, the important part of hearings is that it opens up to the public the work that has been done, makes those who are involved have to respond. The challenge, I think, is going to be that these are four diverse companies with a diverse set of activities, and how you model that into, how you resolve that all into one package is going to be, in a report, is going to be very interesting. I thought, and I wrote a piece for Brookings called The Math, M-A-T-H, Behind the Curtain, and that what the hearing was doing was looking at the effects of the monopoly power of these companies rather than the causes of that power. And the causes of that power is their control of the asset of the 21st century, the capital asset of the 21st century, which is digital information. And all of these companies that were there have a terrific ability to siphon off your information and my information and turn it into their corporate asset, which they then hoard for their own purposes. And it is that data that feeds the algorithms, that does all the targeting and does everything else. And that the cause of their dominance and their anti-competitive activities is their hoarding of this information, their monopolizing of this information. And that at some point in time, we have to push back the curtain and look at that, not just its effects.
I couldn't agree. Couldn't agree more, Tom. And you put it very, very well. As a hoarding and a corporatization of a what is essentially a personal resource. Kara, you've written extensively about this in the New York Times. Let me ask you, what do you think Congress needs to do next? I mean, what we've had this hearing. This hearing seems like one of many we've had in the past 2.5 years since the Cambridge Analytica revelations, or maybe you could even say the past 3.5 years since the election. I remember that first hearing where Facebook, Twitter, and Google, the general counsels all participated and received a grilling from Congress. We haven't really seen much in this country.
None.
In the way of legislative change.
None. We've seen none.
We need to do.
Yeah, I think we've seen none. So let's start from there. So something would be nice. I think what's going to happen here is they're going to do a report. They're going to bring it together and make recommendations that will include some level of regulation, you know, some suggestions of legislation. That's what's going to happen here. That's what Representative Cicilline said. But it's got to be matched by, you know, action in the Senate, which, of course, is, I don't know, it's the biggest traffic jam of all time now, right? Or purposeful traffic. We're going to have a little traffic in the Senate right now, I guess, right? Cause a little traffic jam in the Senate. But I think that that there has to be a national privacy bill. I think that's where it starts, something substantive and stronger than California. I think there's going to have to be there's no fix for anything. There's going to be have to be legislation and laws. Then there's going to eventually laws, and then there is going to be regulation of the existing laws that the FTC and other organizations have. There's going to have to be investigations by the FTC and the Justice Department, which are ongoing. There's one on Google right now. There's one on Facebook. There's one on Twitter. There needs to be an investigation that moves somewhere and has some action. And then there has to be action by state and local officials. Like,
let me ask you, Kara. Sure. Do you think this? I see there being two possible directions that that the committee could try to go. One, collect a lot of information about the companies independently to prepare investigations into each, which could lead to antitrust enforcement of some kind, or collecting a lot of evidence so as to develop kind of a general theory of the internet.
New ideas of what antitrust is. That's the idea. I mean, Lina Khan, it's no accident Lina Khan is on this committee, works for this committee, who has been thinking about it, one who got so much attention for new ideas around antitrust. I mean, you have to figure out an antitrust where it's not harm to the consumer that's the problem. It's harm to society. It's harm to other companies. I mean, I think the biggest problem here, if I had to pick, would be the effect on small businesses that are trying to come up, startups that are trying to come up. And there's one investigation at the FTC looking about how they bought these companies to kill them or to ruin them or to take over them. And I think that, to me, is the inability there to be any innovation in search, in e-commerce, in social media, and in the app area. That's going to be a lot harder. That's something that probably could just be regulated. So you have to look at why there hasn't been innovation in any of those areas. Like in the last time there was a search engine was Never, except recently there's a new search engine called Neva that an ex-Google person is going to be a subscription service. But otherwise, nothing. I mean, there has been a couple of small services, but they have a small part of the market. Someone's got a phone going. I think that's Tom. And then you have in social media, no VC is going to touch a social media site. It's just not. Then Snapchat has to, you know, live under Facebook stealing its every good idea. And TikTok gets attacked by Facebook, of course. And they're about to unveil something called Reels, which is a ripoff, which is what Facebook does best, is rip other people's good ideas off. And then in commerce, Amazon dominates, no matter how they pretend that the retail business is bigger. As we come out of this COVID crisis, retail is decimated. Every day there's a different retailer dying, and Amazon is stepping into this breach, and all of them are doing incredibly well on Wall Street. So you have to start really pushing, how do you get innovative companies that are competitive? Like, that is how you solve this problem, is besides possibly breaking some of them up. But it's not, there's not a catch-all solution. And that's what's so hard, is when they bring tech together as a monolith. It's not a monolith. It's they each require sophisticated policy instead of just talking about big tech as if it's one person.
How do you, let me turn to Oliver and ask, how do you, Oliver, from a political angle, it's very difficult to do precisely what Kara just said, which is to essentially focus on one company, and I don't want to put words in Kara's mouth, but focus on one company and grill it in an independent hearing, or even develop policy around the commercial overreaches of that one company, or the harms that one company is causing, which is why I think people are searching, or some people are searching for this kind of unifying theory. Do you think antitrust can do that? Or do you think that we need to have a separate, let's say, privacy or security policy or offending content policy, offending content being, you know, hate speech or disinformation, for example? Do we have to have separate hearings for each of these companies and apply separate policies to each, or should we be looking for kind of a broader theory of the internet to advance a broader regulatory regime for it? Or is it not just not that simple?
Sorry, I was muted. I do think that it is interesting that all four of them were testifying before the same hearing, because the issues with each of them are very different. But I think one thing actually the Republicans have done pretty well is convinced their supporters that there is an issue with big tech. You know, obviously, I think everyone on this panel disagrees with what they present the issue to be, which is claims of bias, but they've done a pretty good job of convincing their audience that this is an issue. I think that there needs to be a similar, something similar on the other side. I think most consumers would still question, you know, why, for instance, would a Facebook need to be broken up? What's the harm that's being done with them owning Instagram and WhatsApp? And there are some, you know, I don't want to take away from, the arguments that have been made, but I, when I was watching that hearing, and I'm just thinking, if I'm a consumer, I don't, you know, it's still difficult for me to track why I should care about this. Why should, you know, why should the App Store be regulated? It works great for me. You know, I don't see the, I think maybe perhaps the message needs to be simplified. I don't know what it is, but it seems very difficult for me to see, why consumers, you know, if they're just tuning in for 10, 20 minutes, you know, why they should be caring about this. I thought the opening statement maybe made the best argument, but throughout the hearing, it seemed difficult for me to see why, you know, the average person thinks that big tech needs to be regulated, because, you know, I think one thing we don't often perhaps acknowledge is, frankly, a lot of people like these products. So maybe, you know, if someone uses Facebook and they like what they're seeing on Facebook and they like Instagram and they think Google's doing a hell of a job and Amazon's delivering their packages, you know, in a timely manner, they're going to want to know why, you know, government wants to go in there and mess with these companies. And you have to present a very compelling, convincing argument, one that's easy to understand for a large population. I just, every time I watch these things, I just don't feel like I'm walking away with that. I think the documents are damning, but there needs to be a coherent message, and it's difficult because there are four companies and the issues with each of them are vastly different. I hate to be the bearer of bad news. I'm not sure what the actual solution is here, but I think there's definitely a messaging problem. And one of the reasons you would hold a hearing like that is to sway public opinion. I'm just not sure that it was effective in that regards.
I think you're right. The number of times I've been dealing with the same exact question, you know, what does this actually mean? And you know, people love scrolling their Instagram feed and hitting like on so much. And we're addicted to this kind of technology, and addicted in the sense that it has certainly become a part of our lives to wake up to social media, and to several of the other applications offered by the panelists, the witnesses last week. Tom, what do you say to that? This idea, this perspective that there's just no way to really capture these issues in a consumer lens effectively. There's no way to really captivate an audience and illustrate that Facebook is doing harm, and I would argue that the harm does exceed competition issues. But even within the competition framework, you know, the elements that a regulator would typically look for are essentially harms to market innovation, raising of price, and harms to quality of service. And I think we could suggest that. Yes, you know, market innovation, as Kara was suggesting earlier, has been diminished in search and social media. Prices have gone up in the sense that, as you point out, Tom, these companies are exploitatively raking our data at a, you could say, a monopolistic rate, you know, quality of service has gone down as well. If you look at the noise in the information ecosystem, these harms are pretty evident, and yet both on that front and on this broader front of looking at how these companies have become so powerful economically and in the media landscape, which affects our social and political and economic circumstances more broadly, it seems to be clear to so many people, and yet it's very hard to captivate an audience with that message. So what do you say to that, Tom?
A couple of quick points on that, Dipayan, and then let me posit an alternative. A lot of commentators were comparing this to when the tobacco companies were hauled before Congress. It was the big tobacco moment for big tech analogy that was being talked about. I don't think that holds because all of the CEOs of the cigarette companies were putting out the same kind of harmful product. These guys are all different, as everybody has been talking here. But to go to Oliver's point, the reason why antitrust has gotten legs is because people can understand it. When you're running a campaign or when you're trying to communicate to constituents, what can you say in a soundbite that works in a supermarket parking lot and somebody walks out and says, yeah, that's what we ought to be doing? Well, break them up is that kind of answer. And there are all kinds of problems. Kara noted a couple of them. There are all kinds of problems as to whether or not you could actually successfully do that. Antitrust is a blunt instrument. It is inherently uncertain because of the way that since the Reagan years, it has been increasingly watered down. But it is reliably lengthy, meaning that you're talking about legal proceedings that last upwards of a decade. But the concept of, you really got to do something, you got to break them up, is an easy concept to get your head around. It seems to me, however, that what we need to be focusing on is, yes, there are important antitrust issues that need to be addressed here. Yes, hopefully Chairman Cicilline comes out and changes with legislation that does something to change the so-called consumer welfare test that has watered down antitrust law. But it seems to me that if we really want to have an impact, we've got to focus not on break them up, but break them open. What is the asset? Back to my earlier point, what's the cause of their power? It is their monopoly over digital information. And the reason why, as Kara points out, there haven't been new search engines, there haven't been new apps, social media, and other activity, is because the asset that you need to start that business is denied you, and that asset is digital information that you can then package and turn around and sell the use of to advertisers who will pay you. Let's just one example. Facebook was founded 15 years ago, famously in Zuckerberg's dorm room. At that point in time, MySpace was the dominant social media platform, and its principal investor was Rupert Murdoch, by God. And yet, Facebook won the competition with MySpace because of good old-fashioned, my product is better than your product competition. If the four of us today decided we were going to have a new competitor to Facebook because we got a better idea of how to do it, we don't have a hope of being effective competitors because we don't have a hope of getting to the asset that you need to have that competition, which is the digital information. And Facebook has digital information on 1/3 of the population of the planet. So we pat ourselves in the back and say, wow, we've got 100 million people using our new super platform. And Facebook is sitting there with 2.5 billion and the strength that comes from that. And we cannot get access to that. Last point, there are some interesting ideas that are being pursued in other countries. The UK has an interesting process, for instance, where they have forced the major banks to open up the data that they hold on consumers with consumer consent and to make that available to third parties, because the banks were using that to crush competition, control consumers. There are now 200 new applications, 200 new services that have started offering innovative ideas for consumers because they have access to the asset that is necessary for those new ideas.
Let me pose one more question to all three of you, and then turn it to the audience. Much of the discussion around antitrust focuses on whether or not antitrust is the right remedy. When we think about how a competition policy regulator will typically try to look at a company, well, first, as a regulator, you'll get a complaint. A startup or a class of consumers, let's say, might bring you the Federal Trade Commission a complaint that says, look, this has happened, and there's been some anti-competitive conduct here, and we want you to investigate this and pursue a case on this potentially. The regulator will review it and then ask him or herself, if I'm going to use antitrust or competition policy regulation here, first I have to ask myself, is this company a monopoly? And in the U.S., that might mean over 50% per the FTC. In Europe, that might mean over 40%. First, is this company a monopoly? Second, has this company committed harm in the way that has been suggested, or in potentially other ways? If it's a more open investigation, let's say in quality of service or in price or in market innovation. Third, if it is a monopoly, if it has committed harm, then what's the ideal situation here? Could I imagine there being a bunch of different companies all operating in essentially the same space, competing with one another in a vibrant, dynamic marketplace, so long as I potentially break the monopoly up or apply some regulation to the monopoly? Or is this a situation where we have a natural monopoly on our hands, where as Tom, I think you're kind of suggesting, Facebook has imposed these tremendous barriers to entry through imposing both physical and digital infrastructures that kind of assure that it will in perpetuity be the leading company in social media. Have they become natural monopolies like railroads or telecoms in the sense that society should only invest in one, and society should request utility regulation of that one? Which situation do we have on our hands here? And Kara, I'll start with you. And
yeah.
Would be very interested to hear what you think.
Well, interesting. The first time I met Mark Zuckerberg, he called the company when we went out for one of his walks without shoes. He called the company a utility. He kept using the word utility, which was dull because MySpace was around at the time and it was, it was hip and cool and everything else. But he said, we're more like we're blue or like a utility. Well, if it's like a utility, then let's regulate it. Like, yay, that sounds great. A power company. But of course he doesn't want that. He wants to be a utility without having all the duties of a utility. Sorry, that's my new electric bike. Apologies. It's talking to me. So no, it's just, don't even go into it. You'll read about it in my review. So they don't have to under any of the strictures that a utility requires. And it may be that there should only be one social network, but that doesn't make any sense to me. Like these are not natural monopolies. There should be more than one search service. There should be more than one this. There should be more than one major online commerce platform. And as much as Amazon says there's many, they are by far the winner in this area. It's not the same thing as Google and search. They've tried to create search engines, but it's really, there's just no funding for it. And moving people over after they get into a practice, especially when you lock in mapping and other services, you start to have to live in the zone that you live in. And so I don't think they necessarily are like, we all thought no one was going to not use Windows, if you remember, and everybody's not using Windows because the internet came along. So we don't know what is going to be the browser or what's going to be the next thing. But I sure do think there should be more than one in each area. And if not, then we have to regulate them as if they are utilities or as if they are the public squares. They aren't the public squares, but maybe we need to regulate them like they are. I don't know. These are the kind of, I don't think that's probably a good idea to get into that kind of thing. But we do have to start thinking about if they are what they are, then they need to be treated the way they need to be treated, just like every other entity like railroads or anything else. They just don't want to be treated like what they are, but they also don't want to do anything. So that's one of the things that really strikes me, and I'll finish on this, is, Mark Zuckerberg always says, and I say this a lot, he doesn't want to be the arbiter of the truth. For example, this is on misinformation and stuff like that. He says that. Well, why did he build a service that requires an arbiter of the truth? I don't, like, he can't have both ways. And I think that's what a lot of these companies want to have, it is both ways. They want to be seen as dynamic and innovative, and then they want to operate like their utilities, or that there's no other game in town.
I think that's absolutely right. And, in another context, companies like Facebook often hold this line between not being a media company, but not being a platform either.
They call themselves a platiger. I want to just die. I just don't know what to say about that. But they are a publisher. Let's be honest. That's what they are. By the way, they don't get to say what they are. We're always like, what do you think, Mr. Zuckerberg, with your giant brain? What shall we call you? Come on. We do this to every other industry, whether it's chemicals or autos or telcos or banks. We're able to, none of these congressional people can manage these. Yes, they can. They manage all kinds of things they're not that good at. And, that's the way government is. Too bad. That's the way we work here in this country.
Tom, let me jump to you. What's your position on natural monopoly versus not? In other words, should we break them up? Should we use the Elizabeth Warren approach? If you think they're not, or if you think they are, then should we apply more utility sort of regulations on them?
Well, they are not natural monopolies, but they are behaving like monopolies, the same hoarding assets, the same way Rockefeller hoarded oil and kept it from the market, giving him a monopoly position. They are, and they are at the same point in time, critical. I think COVID has shown essential services. And you have to say to yourself, when you step up and have that kind of a critical / essential role that you're playing in the operation of society and the economy, you take on additional responsibilities, one of which is not to act like a monopoly. And therefore, I think that the answer is not old-fashioned utility-like regulation, but regulation that forces them to open that which they are hoarding so that others can have an opportunity to compete. And let's see where that new level of competition takes us. I was back in the wireless industry. I was very much involved in the decision to make the portability of data, portability of the subscriber information, so you could carry it from one wireless carrier to another, and it would create new competition, because previously you had to get rid of your telephone number and start all over again, and that inhibited switching carriers and that inhibited competition. I think we can do similar things like that with the open access sharing of data. I'm not saying that they have to part with their data, but let's go back and quote again. I mean, Zuckerberg says that when our users share, quote unquote, their data with us, okay, so he admits they are consumers are sharing data with him that he then monopolizes. And I'm saying, let's say to him, you need to start sharing that the same way you expect consumers to share with you.
Sorry, I was on mute. And Oliver, what's your take on this? I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I think Karen Tom have made some great points. I don't see why Facebook, for instance, has to own Instagram or WhatsApp. And I think there can be a case made for, you know, if I want to be on Instagram, I don't know why I'm sharing my data with Facebook. And so I think that there is a, you know, there is some possibility there to convince consumers that this is the right path forward. But there's just not many good answers in a lot of other cases. Like they're very complicated problems, and you know, breaking them up, you know, I don't know if that's always the correct answer. I think that these are, you know, there needs to be very nuanced policy regarding all these companies. One thing too, I think would be nice would be just basic giving consumers a right to their own data. Or at least some of their data. You know, these companies have years and years, sometimes decades worth of data now on all their users. There's not much you can do about that. But taking some control back of what, you know, has been given to these companies would be nice. And I think some people could get behind. I guess the short answer is I don't know what can be done. Something needs to be done, obviously. I'm not sure what the solution is. It's very tricky.
Thanks, Oliver. So I'm not hearing definitive answers here. But I think it seems as though we're leaning toward these companies are not natural monopolies, which is a very interesting point, because it might point us toward applying more antitrust enforcement actions to reform the actions of the industry. Let me jump to a few questions from the audience, I'll let any of the three of you field this. But first question from Richard Fink. What are the questions learned from early desires to break up IBM and later Microsoft? And so this is, of course, jumping back to 20, 30 years ago when we had our tech companies had different names, major tech companies had different names. Of course, IBM and Microsoft are still very important, and many were saying Microsoft should be right up there on the witness panel last week. But would any of you want to take this question on? Otherwise, I'm gonna throw it to Kara first, and then Tom, and then Oliver. If you have any comments.
So the question is, how would they like it, or what's good about it?
What are the lessons learned from early desires to break up IBM and later Microsoft?
Well, I mean, I think that Microsoft really wasn't broken up, was it? I mean, like, so it didn't right. quite end that way, but it certainly slowed them down, right? It slowed them down. It allowed the internet to grow up, and people weren't people don't remember. I'm working on my memoir right now, but people were terrified of Microsoft and what they could do. And Bill Gates' famous line, I'll buy you, bury you, or I'll go into business myself and put you out of business. Like, the idea of competing with Microsoft was massive, and it created a real slowness in innovation. It's the same thing here. You know, they're not quite as threatening. Jeff Bezos is friendlier. Mark Zuckerberg seems Mark Zuckerbergian, I guess. I don't know what to say. But it's the same situation, as they're not going to go into it. And so I think the idea is that the minute you remove, say you broke up even their own companies, say AWS off of Amazon, or separated the marketplace from the service, you'd create three really lucrative companies. Now, Jeff Bezos would then become a trillionaire, but nonetheless, you create really exciting economic opportunity. And then they're competing with each other, YouTube competing with Google. Like, suddenly they might have a search service that's safe for children, or an algorithm that's safe for children. It doesn't lead you down a rabbit hole of hate. When you have to compete with people, you think of differentiation. And so I always think that whenever you have breaking up, it's an opportunity, one, for capital gain. So if you're a rich, greedy person, hey, this is good for you. That's how we should sell it to rich people. And then if you're a consumer, you have more choices. I don't think you would have the cell industry if things weren't broken up. I don't think now there's all kinds of statistics back and forth, but anytime there is a splintering of power, more things come up and more opportunity comes up. And I don't see why that wouldn't be the biggest advantage, to create new companies that are worth a lot of money, that have lots of money to spare. And also, you know, I know that sounds crazy, but I can't imagine they like being this big. You know, they like to think of themselves as entrepreneurial, and here I am in my sweatshirt, even though I have, you know, my fortune is bigger than the defense departments of 10 of the top democratic countries. Like, they can't want this. They can't move. They can't do anything exciting. I'm like, I kind of want to be like, Mark, don't you want to be back in the day when you could make things rather than have people say that you're the most dangerous man on the planet? I think it's just it's an economic opportunity to break them up. And that's always been the case with any of these breakups. Instead of seeing it as a negative, it's a great thing we're going to do for you.
Tom, let me go to you. What's your position on what lessons we can take from earlier scrutiny on IBM and Microsoft?
That the principal beneficiaries are the lawyers. Because they take forever. Kara made a really good point that because it takes forever, it can have a chilling effect and allow others to come in. There's an argument that Google never would have started if Microsoft hadn't been tied up with the antitrust case. But I think there's another antitrust case that we ought to pay attention to. And that is that in 1956, the Justice Department and AT&T settled an antitrust case with a consent decree that was very similar to the kinds of issues we're talking about here, where it required AT&T Bell Labs, which was probably had more IQ per square foot than any other place in the country, to open up the patents that they had and to make them available to others to use. We would not have had the internet as we know it today absent that, because, for instance, one of the patents they had locked away was on transistors. And that's the key to microprocessors. Gordon Moore says that decision, Gordon Moore, one of the co-founders of Intel, says that the government forcing AT&T to provide access to the technology for transistors was key to building the modern microprocessor business. One of the other technologies they had hoarded was the modem. We would not have gotten where we are in the internet and through those early days of screeching modems had not modem technology been made available. And so there are multiple solutions that can come out of antitrust action. One of them indeed is breakup. Others can be behavioral conditions that say, no, you're going to take this asset that is the key to your monopoly and open it up. And so I think we need to look at the history of antitrust actions in a broader context than just IBM and Microsoft.
Oliver, unless you want to comment on that question, let me jump to another and ask you whether you feel privacy laws should be updated so that big tech should pay royalties to users of its services when they sell, when big tech sells ads based on users' private activity. Do you think that as an ethical or legal matter, that should be the case? And this question comes from Jim Schuster.
You know, I'm not sure that should be the case. I think it's an interesting idea. I think one, you know, at the core of everything here is just giving consumers the ability to control their data. So maybe they want to sell it, you know, and give it away and they can exchange it for a profit. Maybe they don't. Maybe they want to retain it and they don't want these companies exploiting their data. I think that there should be some options to have control with, you know, what you do on the internet. Even when it comes down to just basic things, you know, I was just thinking this the other day is as after that Twitter hack is, you know, how many people, you know, would like to just maybe wipe out their entire, you know, Gmail inbox. That's a pretty difficult thing to do. And you don't have a real ability to do that. Or you know, if Facebook has a decade's worth of data on you, the only way really, I guess, to maybe get rid of it and start anew is to delete your Facebook account and then sign up for a new one. And I still think then Facebook's still going to retain maybe some of the data. We don't really, I don't think, know how long they would keep the data from that account. So I think even just giving users the ability maybe to control how much data they've shared with these companies and like what, no, you know, like, I don't know, maybe have some sort of control about what these companies have on them on file would be nice. I think a lot of people would opt to maybe not give, you know, maybe they're comfortable with a year of data or something on them, but maybe they don't want, you know, their entire life to be recorded by Facebook. I think there should be some sort of ability to exert authority over what, you know, what kind of information you're handing over to these companies.
Moving forward, and this is for all three of you, moving forward as we approach November, and this question comes from Evie Fuel. Do you all anticipate big tech regulation, antitrust, privacy, maybe the Honest Ads Act from Senators Mark Warner and Amy Klobuchar and John McCain, late John McCain? Do you anticipate big tech regulation in any or all of these forms being a campaign issue? Do you anticipate either the Biden campaign or the Trump campaign pushing anything on these topics, or is maybe not for the wrong reasons, but is big tech as an issue going to be drowned out by the presidential election, which looks like it'll be a very important one in November?
I'd say no, that it doesn't catch on with people. I mean, I think this is all post-election. Anything that's going to go on is going to happen. I mean, this TikTok thing is just a ridiculous distraction by whatever. It's just a ridiculous distraction. And it doesn't really catch on with people, except why are you messing with my TikTok kind of thing. And so I think really that's just an attempt to focus on China, I guess. But what's really happening is that after the election, especially if Biden wins the election, there's certainly a lot of risk for tech companies, all of them, in fact. I think about, you know, Attorney General Elizabeth Warren, think about that. Oh, that's going to be a problem, you know, or an emboldened FTC or an FTC that's fully funded the way it should be. You can see a lot of those things, although we're going to be cleaning up from COVID and these companies are going to make hay during this entire time as they have. They've done incredibly well financially. So that helps them hire a zillion lobbyists, et cetera. and they're the only companies that are really doing really well here is the tech companies. So you're going to see things post-election, I think, because they're going to be scarier than ever because they've been doing so well. They've gotten so big. And whether it's President Trump, I think Facebook will be happy. I think Amazon will be sad. And we'll see where it goes. But I don't think you'll see, you know, maybe legislation or action will come, you know, maybe the week after infrastructure week actually happens in that administration. So we'll see. I'm waiting for that. Looking forward to infrastructure week, as Mary Trump says. So,
Tom, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think look, the new administration is going to have to deal with a pandemic, with an economic crisis, with social inequality, and with the hollowing out of government that has resulted in from as a result of this administration, and that is focusing on those means that the tech issues are not going to be in the top 10 unless they are connected to one of those big four issues, So I think that the chaos right now helps the companies. As Kara said, it helps them grow. And it, you know, there's only so much bandwidth that policymakers have.
Oliver, do you have a 30-second response to this question as well? And then I believe we've got a wrap.
Sure. I think you asked whether this is going to be a campaign issue. I think certainly Republicans will make a big deal out of tech and bias. And the president has repeatedly said he runs against the media establishment and he runs against big tech. You're seeing ads already from people like Donald Trump Jr. about supposed censorship. So whether it's a campaign issue with big tech, yeah, on the Republican side, it's definitely going to be a campaign issue. I don't know how much, you know, this excites the Democratic base. But I think that's very different, obviously, from whether policy is implemented during the next administration, whether it's Trump or Biden. But I think beating up on the powers that be, certainly excites the Republicans. And it excites the Democrats for different reasons. But I can certainly see it being a campaign issue to some degree here.
Well, with that, I'm gonna wrap us, and I think this has been a wonderful conversation, wrapping up kind of the findings from the hearings and what's next. Thank you, Tom, Kara, Oliver, for your participation in this conversation. I really appreciate it. We all do, really look forward to doing this again sometime soon. Hopefully this is the start to something good on the policy front. And thank you all for joining everyone listening. Thank you so much.